Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends, but the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, as though he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Vish's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
I loved you when I had nothing else to do. But you led me on. I shed my big fat heart for you, and now it's gone. CITY Royal City, CITY Royal City, CITY Royal City.
Aaron Riches is a musician and professor currently based in the state of Kansas. Originally from Guelph, Ontario, Riches used to write a lot of songs, and he once played drums and sang in the post-hardcore punk rock band Minnow. He also once played guitar and sang as himself, and He once played guitar and sang in the wondrous outsider folk band Royal City, which also featured contributions by Jim Guthrie, Nathan Lohr, Simon Osborne, Lonnie James, Johnny James, Evan Gordon, Rebecca Simpson, Owen Pallett, Sufjan Stevens, Bob Wiseman, and Leslie Feist, among others. I used to road manage Royal City sometimes. In 2004, Royal City played its last show, and Riches essentially vanished from public life to tend to his family, his schooling, and his teaching career. The Hillside Festival in Guelph asked him to digitally film himself singing a song for their Hillside Homeside virtual festival, which is taking place on the internet between July 24th and 26th in the year 2020. Now, Aaron agreed to do that, and he also agreed to be on this show for his first extensive interview in roughly 16 years, which covered a lot of ground about the state of the world and the state of him and the state of me. Also, Fugazi, the band Fugazi, is mentioned a number of times. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series, live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Great Lake Swimmers, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 553rd episode of Creative Control, featuring the funny, wise, and inscrutable Aaron Riches with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hello, Aaron. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Bish?
I'm well. Where in the world are you today?
I'm in Kansas. I'm at the center of America.
Is that geographically correct? Are you in the state of Kansas or are you in Kansas City? This has become a hotly debated topic in the last year or so. Where are you?
Yeah. You mean because Trump congratulated the state of Kansas when Kansas, Missouri won some football or baseball thing?
That's correct. That is exactly what I'm alluding to. And yes, which Kansas are you in?
Well, Kansas City, most of Kansas City is in Missouri, but a little bit of it is in Kansas State. But I'm in Kansas State, not in Kansas City. I'm in a very small town. We do have a Manhattan, Kansas, which is much closer to being the center of America than Manhattan, New York, geographically speaking. Of course, culturally, politically, and all kinds of other ways, I feel like I'm on the frontier.
Right. We think of Kansas as a frontier state, not the center of any universe. But did you decide to move to Kansas because you wanted to be in the center of America?
For strictly geographical reasons, I moved here.
What are you doing in Kansas, if I may ask?
I'm teaching at a little college here.
Oh, okay.
And so, yeah, it's good.
How long have you been in Kansas?
I've been here almost 2 years now.
Oh, okay. I see. I didn't know that. You and I will correspond over email every once in a while, and I noticed a slightly Spanish flavor to your emails in the last little while, and now it's got a Kansasian feeling.
Yeah, a Kansan.
Kansan, that's
a
right.
Kansan feel. We spent almost 9 years in Granada, mm-hmm. in Spain, El Culo de Europa, which is not a very nice thing to say about a place. But it actually isn't. It's a very beautiful, beautiful city, very significant culturally, architecturally, in every kind of way. I had a beautiful time there.
So you must be, what, are you trilingual at this point?
No, I'm not. I'm barely unilingual.
Yeah, I can attest to that. You know, my children and I are you familiar with the application Duolingo?
No.
Duolingo is a how to learn languages application. You can get it on in your telephone or on your personal computer. And basically, you and your children together every day can go on Duolingo and you're assigned a language exercise. And you can pick French or Spanish or Japanese, whatever you want. And you can start from scratch together. So we've just, because I've instituted a kind of Papa summer camp, I'm doing my best to give them something to do, some structure to their days. We do Duolingo every day. So we're on Spanish. We alternate every day. Every other day we do Spanish. We do Spanish and French. We alternate. So yesterday we did Spanish. And tell me if you know what this means. And tell me if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Yo come manzanas mañana.
Qué tonto eres, tío. La pronunciación no fue muy bien, pero...
See, you've got it. You've got Spanish.
Manzanas, sí.
Manzanas.
Manzanas. Pues quizás en mexicano son manzanas, pero
En
España son manzanas.
I see.
Pero no pasa nada.
Okay, see, you've got it. You've got... You would be an advanced Duolingo if you were to
get... on Duolingo, I can do advanced.
That was good. So I got it wrong? Did you... I was trying to say...
No. You said that you ate apples and it wasn't too bad.
I was trying to say I'm going to eat apples tomorrow. Did I say it wrong?
Yo come.
I said come, but is it como?
Yo comore.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay, see, I don't know. I'm just... Don't berate me. I just started.
Come?
Come?
Come.
Como? Como. Jeez. Anyway, it's nice to see you and talk to you, as always. So your family's good? Are you okay?
Yeah, we're really good here, sort of in the lost part of the United States.
Mm.
It's great because it's a very small town. Makes Guelph look like a megalopolis, a cosmopolitan center of a very dynamic, dynamic place. I mean, Guelph seems cosmopolitan, positively next to Atchison, where we live.
I can't figure you out. Are you a small town person or a big city person? You seem to live in both very easily.
I live wherever I'm put. I'd rather live for myself in a bigger place, more cosmopolitan place. But you know, the thing that's really nice about where we live now compared to Spain is that the kids are free, so they can go into the streets, they can go biking. Like even the little kids are free, and there's lots of families that live around here in houses, and they go in and out of each other's houses, and that's good. In Granada, like, we had an apartment, and you went out onto the street and there was like motos zooming past all the time and cars and there was a house of prostitution across the street. You know, like, I mean, it just wasn't the kind of place where you'd let your 8-year-old go out by themselves.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so I think for that reason, it's nice to live here. I mean, it's not, I mean, I never knew what Atchison was until I got offered a job here. So I don't have I never had a need to live here.
And what are you teaching there?
I teach theology.
Theology? Any specific area of expertise?
Well, yeah, I mean, I teach everything because it's a little liberal arts college, so you have to teach everything to get by. So
now, what does that mean, though? Everything? Theology is a broad subject in my mind. Is there some? Do you home in on something specific? I think theology. How would you define what theology even means? Because to me, it's the study of religion generally, but is there a specific area?
Well, I mean, I teach Catholic theology. So.
Okay, so there you go. You home in on the Catholicism.
Home in on the Catholicism, yeah. Mm,
okay.
So I teach this semester, I teach a few intros to theology, intros to Catholic theology. So they're not, we have a class that's like a world religions course, but I don't teach it. And then I'll teach a theology of the church class. Hmm. And, you know, sometimes I get to teach some elective classes that are sort of my own. I make them up. And, yeah.
You know, my mom, before she retired, was a chemist. And every few years I talked to her about something to do with work. And she'd say, oh, well, I have to attend a seminar, about, you know, to upgrade my skills. So when you're teaching Catholicism, how much upgrading are you doing? What kind of new innovations?
Just downgrading. It's just the process of downgrading.
You're just constantly downgrading every year. You're learning a little bit less about what
I try to forget a couple of things I've learned.
You and I came to know each other because of punk music, questioning all authority a little bit, I would say, or, well, maybe that is an unfair thing to suggest that you were doing. But that's what appealed to me about it, fighting a little bit. How do you reconcile that mindset with, you know, the questioning of authority with what you're doing now, with some of the more strict religious things you must adhere to, the parameters? That's what I'm wondering about. How do you reconcile those things, punk and parameters?
Well, I mean, actually, they're already reconciled to me in my mind. I mean, everybody has authorities in their life that they follow. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what is an authority and what is an authority to me? I mean, Ian MacKay was a great authority to me because he showed me a great humanity, right? And he showed me, therefore, a great way. And so whatever authority he had was something that he received freely from me because I wanted to follow.
Yeah.
The way that he did things impressed me, impacted me. And in that sense, you know, authority and, let's say, authority and anarchism aren't really diametrically opposed. But I think that the biggest question is sort of, what is authority? And for me, authority is a presence that captures my heart.
Right. Okay. So it doesn't necessarily need to be an authority that espouses a dogma. It could be an authority that simply lives a life, leads by example to an extent. You know, it's funny you bring this up because did I send you the link where I had Ian MacKay and Steve Albini in a conversation together? Did you ever catch wind of that?
I probably did. I'm not sure that I listened to it.
It's many, many years ago now.
Maybe I did. I'm not sure.
Well, it's funny you bring it up because I revisited it somewhat recently. I don't remember when. And they each bristled, each of them, when I brought up the notion that they were leaders in the punk world, or authority figures. They both said, well, that's not accurate. That's not how I view things. I think there was a little semantic stuff going on. I mean, obviously I was having them both on the show together because whether they like it or not, we viewed them as kind of leaders, figureheads. But they and instantly were like, we don't view ourselves that way. No, this is just what I did. If people want to follow that example, I mean, that's their prerogative. But they just bristled at that. What do you make of that?
It depends. It depends what kind of definition of authority you had. And most people that have a great authority don't attribute it to themselves.
Right. Okay.
Right? It's something that's given to them. Martin Luther King was a great authority. He was a great leader. Hmm. Not because he demanded doctrinal coherency with his position, not because he told people what to do, but because people spontaneously looked to him and they followed him. And so it's more, authority is less a thing you can attribute to yourself and more a thing that others attribute to you. I mean, of course, you can try to impose it on other people, but we all know how that ends.
Yeah. I think we tend to find an affinity with certain people because their sense of logic or common sense resonates with our own. So with people like Steve and Ian, I think part of, and you, I will say you as well. I mean, in Guelph, I thought of you as someone who, and I think a lot of people would say that when you lived in Guelph and when you lived in Toronto and when you were making music and in the arts world, I think people gravitated towards you because they felt like you kind of had a sense of what made sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly I would bristle even more than probably Ian MacKay would bristle for good reason to think anything of that of myself. But I think that it's not even that it's something you can put your finger on. It's something that the heart sees in another, and you see a humanity that surprises you. And you think in yourself, I want that. Like, I want that in the case of like Ian MacKay, like, I want that kind of integrity. I want to be able to live like that. And it wasn't that I wanted the program, the list of rules that I had to obey, but you wanted to be around him because you wanted to kind of, you wanted to participate in that sort of that human presence. But, and that's what real authority is.
But I think in both the religious context that we were referring to and in the case of Ian, Steve, you, part of what you're doing on some level when you find that humanity in your heart is you want to take it into your own world. You want to take it into your own community. Yeah. I know so many people who saw Discord Records, for example, as this is an amazing, incredible thing. But when they actually focused in on it a bit more, they're like, wait a minute. Almost everyone on Discord is from their community. It's not some conglomerate that's just like soaking up artists from different scenes. And I feel like you, whether you know it or not, and I appreciate the bristling, and I think I did it when I was in Guelph in particular as well. You try to take the things that made sense to you in terms of what people like Ian or other leaders did, and you bring it to Guelph. You bring it to your town. You bring it to your community and your scene and see if it works. Would you say you tried some of that? I mean, you are famous for bringing Fugazi to Guelph in what year was that? 88, 89 or something like that?
Yeah, 88 or 89, something like that.
And you wrote them a letter, is that right?
No, I had a friend in Kitchener-Waterloo who had, he had met Ian MacKay. I think he met Ian MacKay, like, I mean, he was older than me.
Yeah.
And I think he had met him at, like, I think Minor Threat played one show in Canada ever in Windsor.
They played in Winnipeg, I think.
Or Winnipeg. But did they play a show in Windsor once?
They might. They could have. I know they played. I believe they played some prairie shows. Anyway, yeah.
You probably know this better than me. But anyway, this guy had met Ian MacKay like then and had kept in touch with him. And you know, I remember at the time, the distance between Minor Threat and Fugazi in 1988 seemed like, you know, like generations. But in fact, it was only like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, most of my kids are older than that.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, so he had Ian MacKay's phone number and he gave me his phone number. And so I phoned Ian MacKay up on the phone and I said, yeah, you know, my name's Aaron and I live in this place called Guelph and we'd really like it if you would come up here. And he said, and play a show. And he said, well, we're not doing a tour right now, but we're planning to do one probably in about 6 or 8 months. I'll give you a call. And I said, okay. And then one day the phone rang like in the kitchen, you know, I mean, the phones were all like landlines back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know, maybe it was my mom that answered. Somebody said, you know, Aaron, the phone's for you. And I came over and he said, hi, this is Ian MacKay from Fugazi.
Right.
And we talked before and we're going to come up and play these shows. And the only shows they played on that tour in Canada were Guelph, Toronto, and Montreal.
Ottawa?
Maybe they played Ottawa too, but I don't think they did that tour. Maybe they did.
Okay.
You probably know better than me.
I just vaguely tried to.
It's like with Michael Barclay. If you talk to these guys, like they actually write stuff like this down and remember. But anyway, I think that Guelph was like maybe even the first gig that they played in Canada on that leg of the tour. But it was significant. It was like this little town of back then, like 80,000 people.
Yeah. So tell me about the impulse you had to call them. Think about that for a second. Think about what you were doing then. It was a different time. There was no email. You mentioned the landlines. You couldn't really reach out to the people you admire as easily as you can now on Twitter or what have you. Like, you couldn't message them. But that impulse to make something happen in Guelph, to bring Fugazi to Guelph, what was that? What was within you there? Was it because you knew a little bit about Discord? You knew a little bit about Ian? What was it?
Yeah, of course I knew about Discord and I knew the whole, the thing is when Fugazi started, there was something different about them. There's something like, there was no other band that sounded like them, but there was no other band that was like, you know, sort of principled like them. There was no other band that was sort of like for the young people who would want to come to their shows. Like, I mean, DIY is such a stupid slogan. It doesn't capture anything like the newness that Fugazi was. And so I remember my friend Eric Hunter came home with this like cassette tape when he'd been in Germany and Fugazi had played over there. And this was like their first demo. And we heard it and we were like, man, this is like, it didn't sound like punk rock. It didn't sound like hardcore. It didn't sound like Miles. It sounded like a whole new thing. Like nothing like this had ever happened before.
Right.
And then their whole way of being was like, they were, you know, people getting into trouble for stage diving, right? What are you doing? I mean, it stopped songs. It said, what are you doing, man? You just hit this person in the head. It was like, they cared about the humanity that they were playing music for. And this was, of course, always the thing that attracted anyone that I knew to punk rock. Was like punk rock was like a place where you could belong. Every human being needs a dwelling place, right? Everybody needs a place where they belong, where they're affirmed in their humanity, where their friendships have some kind of sense, a point of reference. And punk was that for us. And then Fugazi came and it was like this, like, it was almost like a more beautiful form of it, a more conscious, more mindful form of it. It was like, no, you don't stage dive because you might hurt somebody. And like, we don't play gigs that are more than $5 a head. I remember that show actually in Guelph. The first conversation I had with Ian Mackay said about the $5 price tag. And I explained to him, like, you know, that I wasn't sure if we'd be able to break even with $5. And we worked out, because of the exchange rate difference, that it could be $6.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So one of the things, I mean, all the bands that played back then, you know, they had a guarantee. Fugazi had no guarantee. The guarantee was that it's all ages.
Yeah.
And that it's $5.
Right.
You know, and that, you know, people aren't allowed to jump off the speakers onto other people's heads.
It's so interesting because I think the sort of general sense of punk is that it is filled with anarchy and nihilism and anger. And yet what spoke to me about Ian and Fugazi and you and people like that was there was this sense of decency that you're describing, this sense of, well, no, we're human beings. This is not some entity. This is not some dispassionate gathering. This is a very human enterprise, a very human thing to gather together in a space and share that space. And when you share that space, that share is a very important word there. And I think that really, and I think the tension for people who were like, they're telling us we can't do stuff. That's authority. Well, no, I never viewed it that way. I viewed it as just a reminder that we have a responsibility to be decent to one another. Yeah. And I think that's what, and that's easier said than done. We all slip up. We all make mistakes. We all, as you would know, knowing me, we all inadvertently insult people or say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing sometimes. But that decency really resonated with me. It's a weird thing to talk about, that a rock band could instill decency in us. But would you agree that's there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've often thought this, like at the core of punk rock always has been an incredible love of freedom, right? That's the real thing. It's like it's freedom. And within that freedom, of course, there's an anti-authoritarianism in the sense of the kind of wooden, self-appointed, sort of dictatorial authoritarianism. And I think that's one aspect. But this love of freedom, it then becomes an exploration of the question of, like, what is freedom? And there is always a nihilistic, in punk rock, you see it, like, right from the beginning, like the Sex Pistols and the Clash.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
You know, you got, like, bands like Conflict, and you got the Dagelow Abortions.
Right.
Right. Like, I mean, so there's always been like one is just a sort of empty, nihilistic freedom, which is just like a pure chaos. And the other one is like, you know, the question of a deeper sense of freedom, a love of humanity, a love of my brothers and sisters, and a genuine search for peace. And so a lot of those bands were like into nonviolence, into really, I think, trying to solve in a personal way the problems of discord between people. And there was the feeling that playing in these bands and playing these little shows actually, like, in its own small way, didn't solve the problem, but was a window into a way of being together that wasn't determined by the problem. And it was like a kind of sacred space, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Minuteman History Lesson Part 2 is like a song that, like, when he says, you know, Mr. Narrator, this is Bob Dylan to me. And we all knew what Bob Dylan meant. Bob Dylan didn't mean a guy who had a record deal and made a lot. It meant a guy who stood on a stage at a time, like Gril Marcus says it, but like 1963, the times they are changing, like a new kind of way of being together. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't at the best of times. Punk rock is not ideological, right?
Right.
It's not ideological. It's actually the experience of the hoped for reality, lived now in the presence of this little huddle of friends.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's well said. That's well said. You know, we've been talking about leadership. We've been talking about liberty or freedom. You say you've been in Kansas about 2 years. It's the year is 2020. So you moved to America in 2018. I assume you knew what you were in for in terms of the current leadership and sociocultural political climate of that country. You and I explored that country together in a way that I never have since. Like, you and I went on a 3-week tour in 20 years ago this fall. And that has always meant a lot to me, but I feel like I learned a lot. When we went, oddly enough, it was an election year.
You were in the Ralph Nader buttons.
That's right. I would get harassed for wearing the vote for Ralph Nader button that I picked up in Nashville at, what was her name? Kira, I think her name was. Nashville. Remember she ran the Springwater?
Yeah, yeah. And you have a better memory than me too, which is an unfortunate thing for me.
Oh, no, it's good. Anyway, is it unfortunate? Why? Why is it bad?
Well, because I just can't remember things. I barely remember. Yeah. But anyway, yeah.
I got the pin at, we were staying at, it's hard to say his name now, obviously, but we were staying at Ryan Adams' house. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Right. So we were staying at,
I had forgotten that we stayed at his house.
Don't you remember you and I slept? Okay. First of all, we got there and we got to explore the house and he had this bizarre basement that seemed like
He wasn't there.
He was. So basically me and Simon, there was a drum kit and a bass amp set up and maybe a guitar amp. And maybe Jim and I and Simon went down there to just play. Simon was starting to play louder music with other people and he wanted me to help him get used to playing louder punk rock. I think he was playing with our friend Evan Clark and was trying to get used to it or something. So Simon and I go down there, and I think Jim was there for maybe a second or someone, maybe Nathan, and they left. And Simon and I'm on drums, Simon's playing bass.
And Ryan Adams came down and played with you.
We played for quite a while, and we just thrashed, and I was super into shellac at the time. I mean, I still am, but I was playing just heavy drum beats. And Simon was playing, and it was great. It was fun. And we finished playing, and Ryan Adams, who I didn't know at all, really, we stopped and he said, "That was incredible. I never get to play like that. We have to play a show tonight." And I said, "What? That wasn't anything. That was just noise." I mean, I appreciated that it was fun noise, but I said, "Well, no, Royal City, you and I were on tour with your band, Royal City. They've got a show or two shows tonight in Nashville. I can't play with you." And so I didn't, and we didn't. And so we went and played. Remember we played that amazingly horrible, you guys played that showcase? At the
You did
the most punk rock thing I've ever seen, because everyone else was like a wannabe singer songwriter and you guys played Success by Iggy Pop and was the angriest version of Success I'd ever heard you sing, and I was just like it was just, you know what I just found yesterday, because I'm moving stuff around because we just moved to Edmonton and I'm still unpacking, I found the tapes of our, do you remember I was taping everything? I was taping all the shows on that tour. I'm not even kidding. Last night came upon the tapes. So it says like Royal City, Flint, Michigan, Royal City, Kansas City, wherever we played. Or maybe we didn't play Kansas City, but anyway, I found all the things. Anyway, where was I going with this? We were there during an election year. I was wearing a Ralph Nader for President pin. People yelled at me. People yelled, "You're losing us the election." And yeah, I said, "No, I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm Canadian. How am I going to do that? But they yelled at us. Anyway, you moved there during Trumpism, during this time. Conflicts? Did you think about moving back to Canada instead? I know you got a job, but...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. In Atchison, I mean, I sort of live on the frontier, on the periphery. I mean, I don't really bump into too much here, and I'm sort of, I mean, I don't have a mobile phone. I'm not as plugged in as most people are to the to the whole of it. Like I don't feel the election thing day to day in my life. It's like this big existential thing. What I do think is, I mean, what has been harder for me, you know, is like, I mean, the death of George Floyd and like all the stuff that's happened after that. That's a big provocation, right? As a Canadian, I mean, I guess my place in it all is different. I don't claim to have things figured out, but this is an incredible moment in this country's history. The election is a big part of it, but you know, the coronavirus lockdown exploding into the death of this man, complete injustice. I mean, there's no one that would say that. But then all the social unrest, and then the question of like the legacy of slavery and segregation and stuff is an incredible moment. But to me, you know, it's been also, I have to say, it's been a fascinating time to be here, because I've been provoked. I mean, on our campus, there's a lot of questions too. You know, people want to try to live this well, and it's an opportunity to be challenged, to be corrected, and to become different. And you know, I mean, when I'm washing up at night, I listen to Martin Luther King speeches and Malcolm X speeches. I want to know something about the history. I discovered this beautiful poet named Claude McKay, not Mackay, McKay.
Mm-hmm. Just and, McKays and Mackays all throughout your life, it seems.
Yeah. But this Claude McKay was a Harlem Renaissance poet. Mm-hmm. And If We Should Die is this a poem that they read at a lot of the protests and riots. And I see that, like, you know, the impact of this really terrible moment has provoked in me a some kind of a journey. I don't know where it's going. But so I'm actually grateful to be here right now.
It's an interesting perspective to have, obviously, as a Canadian being in America. You mentioned you're fearing for your children's safety in Spain. This conflation of events is so surreal and bizarre that I wonder how you're feeling about... By the way, you have, what, is it 13, 17 children? I forget. I've lost track of how many children you currently
have. I only have five kids.
Five kids. Yeah, you're slacking a little bit. You and Brendan Canty, five kids, I think. Brendan may have more than that.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah. I can't remember. I can't keep track. Something about drummers and making children. I don't know. Punk rock drummers.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I stopped at two, and I think I'm good. My point here is explaining this to your children while there. I haven't really had to broach too much. My kids know there's a coronavirus, obviously. There's lots of restrictions. I have a vague sense of what's going on with the Black Lives Matter movement and social unrest. Are you having conversations with your children about what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my son Basil, we talk with a bit. It's really hard to know how to broach it well with children. But what I do know is that I've made a kind of promise to myself that we're gonna sit down and watch some of Martin Luther King's speeches. Like, I mean, because they're such incredible things. Like, I mean, outside of the bare proposal and anything else, just the oratory, the compellingness again of this, like, this man with great authority, right? Because he had a humanity that you couldn't look at him and see him and not feel the kind of the purpose and not want to kind of follow him in a certain sense, like, you know, And so, you know, I want to start there with him, but it's, yeah, it's hard to know how to discuss it with kids. And of course their lives had not been part of the American experience at all before 2 years ago. So it's a strange time.
Yeah. It's fast. That's an excellent, idea, I think, to show them Martin Luther King's speeches, because I think his legacy has been, and I don't mean to be a use a pun here, but I feel like it has been whitewashed. I was just rewatching the Spike Lee film Malcolm X a couple weeks ago. I hadn't watched it in a long time, and it just reminded me how Martin Luther King's message was very similar to what's going on now. Like, there was this sense that he was more of an Uncle Tom than Malcolm X, so to speak, that he was advocating for an idealism when something more militant along the lines of what Malcolm X was espousing needed to be done. But I feel it's, as you probably discovered in revisiting the speeches, what he said, what Martin Luther King said, is very much what proponents of Black Lives Matter have been saying and are saying. I don't feel like there's a great distance between his messaging and the current messaging. What do you make of that?
I mean, I'm not sure about all the messaging. I mean, I think that the thing is that the origin in every case is the thing which is the most true, right? And there's a desire, again, this is like punk rock, desire for freedom, a desire, like, you know, what does it mean to say Black Lives Matter? It means, like, I want my life to matter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What does that mean? It means I want to be loved. I want to be recognized as someone who's beautiful, who's cared for.
Yeah.
And at least that's what I think. I mean, what the hell do I know? I'm just a Canadian white kid. But that seems to me to be the thing, like, at its very core is this. And that is the thing that, you know, even the different phases of Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, they're all giving voice to that same thing. Like, no. I want this life to matter.
Yeah.
Like, I love this one. Like, this one is my son.
Yeah.
Don't treat him like that, because I love him.
Right.
Therefore, he's beautiful. So great. I read a great thing about Martin Luther King in Chicago. Some woman came up to him when he was marching there, and, you know, she yelled all kinds of terrible profanities at him. And he just looked up at her, and he looked her in the eye. I mean, this is like part of the nonviolent thing, right? Because you always make eye contact. He looked her in the eye and he said, "How can someone as beautiful as you say things like that to a man?" And he just kept on going.
Yeah.
And the next day, she found him in another march, and she came up to him and she said, "I am sorry for what I said."
When I think of what Black Lives Matter means, I mean, it is, I've made this argument before, Aaron, and I know that you've generally, your friends make fun of you a little bit for being a bit disconnected from social media, from technology. I texted you today to say, "Do you know how to text?" Which just made me laugh out loud as I was writing to you. But you were onto something there, I think, because maybe you had a sense of how dehumanizing all of this is. You probably don't even know what I'm talking about, because you've insulated yourself, probably for your own, whether you know it or not, for your own health and well-being. The rancor, the anonymous vitriol that we face, those of us who engage on the internet or witness people engaging in, is a level of inhumanity and a lack of decency and decorum that I've not encountered in my life. And that's been building since we started using these disembodied platforms. I think it's been building to this point, and now it's out in real life. So the internet trolls and commentators and posters, the people who are going to say something negative no matter what you say, are now feeling so brazen that they can say it to you to your face. So it's interesting that you mention the Martin Luther King parallel, because that was well before the internet and that sort of this is what Black Lives Matter means to me personally. It is a way of re-emphasizing the fact that these are human beings. All of us are human beings, because I've been on the receiving end of negative messages. And when I write back to someone and say, "I'm sorry you feel that way," or I'm sorry this wasn't for you. They write back invariably to say, thank you. I didn't realize you someone was going to read this. I didn't realize that you would respond to me. You know, they just thought they would shoot their shot and it would just go out into the world. And so your country, I think, is really, in our country, our society, our culture is really dug ourselves a hole by embracing all of this anonymous interaction, I think.
Yeah, well, this is a whole other issue. I mean, I think that the great genius is the Canadian Marshall McLuhan, right? The medium is the message.
Yes.
And unfortunately, the internet and all of this technology, it is itself the message. And it is a message that is inherently inhuman.
Yeah.
And I say this to my students. I say, the only thing you can do on the internet with your friend is figure out the time and place that you're going to meet. But don't think at all that on the internet you can really generate friendship. You need a carnal presence. You need somebody that can put their arm around you. You know, Martin Luther King could only say to this woman, how could someone as beautiful as you say a thing like that to a man? If he could look her in the eye,
yes,
right? And I mean, I think that Emmanuel Levinas said, like, inscribed in the face of every man is the commandment, thou shalt not kill, right?
Yeah.
And I actually think there's even more than that written in the face. I think Levinas was onto something, but I think it's even more. It's like, it's the mystery of the depths of being that's written in the face of a man or a woman.
Yeah.
Right? Like that he, here is one who is irreplaceable in all the history of humanity. This one will, when George Floyd died, when you watched that, you thought, man, this one disappeared. Like he was crushed. And you could kind of feel the break in the kind of ontological fabric, like the waste, right? The waste, because he was a human being.
Yeah.
Right. And no one, I mean, some people can, I guess, objectify a human being to such a point that they don't see that, but only at the detriment of their own humanity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And therefore it's almost a kind of act of suicide. I mean, that goes right to James Baldwin, right?
Yes. Says, yes.
You know, the Negro is not my problem. The Negro is your problem.
Right.
Why did you need a Negro?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he sees that actually the problem in America is a deeper problem for whites than it is
absolutely
for blacks. Absolutely. On one level.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much I'm not going to get into how loaded racism is and how much it's mired in insecurity and competitiveness, because I think that's all there. It is at the root of it. It is, and maybe you can comment on it if you want, but I've talked about this a few times on the show recently, and I think that's when people hate and try to overpower someone, I think it says more about them than those they're trying to oppress. If that makes any sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's James Baldwin's point.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And the thing is, what we all want, and this goes right back to the original cry, you know, what we all want is to be loved. We all want to be happy. Like even the white man who's doing the horrible thing of lynching or something like this. I mean, at the very core of it, he too wants to be looked at with a merciful gaze of love. And the trouble with hate and violence is that it makes you incapable of receiving that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. We've talked about all sorts of things in terms of cultural things. We've talked about poetry. We've talked about oratory. I want to ask you about music. We connected as friends because of music. You've shared music with me that has changed my life in so many ways, and whether it's your own or others, just recommending things. How has music helped you in maybe this time, if at all? And what is your relationship like with music? Because the narrative around Aaron Riches is that he was in a band called Royal City, and then the band stopped, and Aaron vanished. Aaron stopped making music in public, and no one exactly knows why. And I want to get to that as briefly as we can. I know why, because I know you, but I think I know why. Tell me about your relationship with music at the moment and whether you see yourself still as someone who might or does still make music.
Well, I play music every single day. I mean, not a day goes by that I don't pull the guitar out. And my kids sing songs with me. We even have like tunes that we've been trying to kind of work up, not for a concert. We don't play concerts, but you know, I mean, my son and I have been working a lot on Townes Van Zandt, If I Needed You. And it's great because he's got a really nice way of playing the leads. And then we're going to work on a, of all people, Carla Bruni song, Quelqu'un m'a dit. Do you know that?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very popular, yeah. But it's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
I know it's almost like this song by Melania Trump. Not quite, but I mean, you know, as far as like, you know, a very fashionable Italian.
Yeah.
Could marry Starkozy. But anyway, I love that song. So we've been working on that too. And with my daughter, I have a couple of songs we like to sing, and she plays flute, and we've got a great Spanish song. She's got a good flute part in, and we just play them around the house.
So these are other people's songs. Are you?
I don't even try to write songs anymore.
I don't have the.
A friend of mine wrote words for me to write put to an Italian friend of mine when I was in Milan with him, just on my way actually moving here. He wrote these two poems that are actually meant to be songs. And gave me the words. He said, "Please put these to music." And so I actually did for one of them, and then I completely forgot it because I didn't play it for too long. So I had to write Giovanni and say, "I'm just such a shit because I did this, but now I forgot it." So I've got to kind of do that for him just as a personal gift. But I don't have that. I guess I don't have that need. And so I would say in some way, music's become a much purer thing to me now.
Because it's more personal?
Yeah, because it's just, I mean, I sing songs that I love. I sing them for myself, sing them for my family. I love, so every once in a while, I go over to somebody's house and I bring the guitar and, you know, we sing songs together. But I love music now more than I ever did. And I play more probably than I did a lot of the time when I was in bands.
What do you think snuffed that spark? You've played in bands for, when did Rail City stop? In 2003 or 2004 or something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah. And you started playing music as a teenager, right? So it's in the mid-80s or something?
Yeah.
Right. So from the mid-80s, let's say it was around 20 years, you played music publicly, I would say, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Right. What extinguished that desire? Was it the public aspect of it?
Well, no. I have played a couple of times how I consider publicly. I mean, like we had a vacation in Spain, and like I played for like a whole hour. I played a whole bunch of songs. I even played a couple of Rail City songs for my friends in Spain. This vacation was like there was about 40 people there, and I printed out all the lyrics and like I taught them how to sing along to certain songs, and I told them why I like these songs. So like I love that.
Okay.
But what I don't want anything to do with is, you know, the business and then there's another thing, which is like the ego of writing songs. That's corrosive of my eye. It's not good for me. It's not what I want.
That's what I was getting at. I used the word public, I guess, which is clumsy, but I wondered if it had something to do with ego.
It's hard, especially if you're the guy who like writes the songs and sings them, it's probably hard not to have a struggle with it. And I'm just as fragile and fallible and clumsy and whatever as anybody else. So of course I gave in to all kinds of ego stuff, of wanting to be things that I wasn't, and wanting to be things that in the end, you know, no fragile mortal should think of. This is exactly why Ian MacKaye and Steve Albini bristled at the idea of authority. It's like, you can't attribute that to me. But of course you can't attribute the glory of the Lord to any human being.
Sure.
But anyone who watches I Have a Dream and doesn't know the glory of the Lord rested on that man is a fool.
Right. Because
it's evident.
Right.
What Aristotle said, the only thing, the most irrational thing is to deny what is in evidence. You don't have to question it. It just is. But the fact is that when you play songs, your own songs, you can get caught up into a lot of ego and stuff. And so it was time for me to not be part of that. And I'm pretty glad that, I'm pretty glad that my life took the turn that it did. I mean, I'm grateful for the turn that it took, especially for, I lived almost a decade in Spain. So I really lived in a cone of cultural silence, where like the students that I had there were, I taught at a Catholic seminary. I mean, they had no idea. I mean, some of them did, but for the most part, they had no idea that I'd ever played in a band. They didn't know who I was,
Right.
It was great. It was this freeing thing. And that's when it was when I was in Spain that I really got into learning to play other people's songs. And, another person's song is a great freedom because like they say in their words, all the whole infrastructure of your heart, right? They put it all out there and you can actually just like play that in the park and people can listen to it or not listen to it. And it's like, it doesn't matter to me. Right. It's not like I'm playing my baby out here. I'm just playing this tune. It was written by Richard Thompson. I'm just playing this tune. It was written by Claudio Chiaffo. And people like it or don't like it, but I don't care. I love it. It changed my life.
Okay.
So, and that's what I love about not playing songs that are my own.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I think a lot of people, I get this question a lot. I've become something of a Royal City emissary. Just people wonder what I know. And I say, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, these things happen. If I text you something, a photo right now, I alluded to the fact that I'm not sure how up on technology you are. Can you see?
I've got iMessage. Go for it.
Okay. I'm going to text you something. I want you to tell people what it is I'm texting you and tell me a little bit about it.
Oh, that's my snare case.
That is your snare drum. It is in Edmonton, Alberta. That is your snare case and snare drum. And somehow in my packing, I don't know how I feel like our friend Tristan O'Malley had it at his house. And then it just came with me wherever I lived. And when it came time to move, I didn't even think twice. I'm like, yeah, that's coming. That's your snare case. What do you make?
That's great.
Well, is it great? I see in your face that you wish you had it back. Why does Vish have my stuff?
No, Vish. Actually, if you hadn't left Guelph, I might have just come to your house any day with all of my records and said, just deal with this. I can't.
Can you do me a favor, and for everyone listening, can you describe what you're seeing there and tell us anything about this particular snare drum, where it was used, and where this case maybe? It says Lufthansa on it. I see that. So it's obviously, it traveled around. What is this?
It traveled.
What does this make you think of?
Well, it makes me think of the minnow tour that we did in Germany. I guess that it was that. I don't think that it was. I don't think that this snare drum was taken on a Royal City tour.
No, it probably wouldn't have been.
So it's great though. It's got a conflict sticker on it. Jawbreaker. Corporate rock still sucks.
Yep.
I mean, I think corporate everything still sucks, right?
Yeah.
The trouble is that we live in a world that has become more corporate than ever before, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can't get out of it. Even Nike wants to endorse Black Lives Matter. It's
yes.
just incredible. It's incredible.
Yes.
It's okay not to drink. So there's a little bit of a straight edge nod there. I think it's okay not to drink. I mean, I don't happen not to drink, but I really like to have a beer at the end of the day.
I still think it's okay not to drink for whatever that's worth. That's just me. It's okay to drink. It's okay not to drink, but I'm with the sticker. Also, King Cobb Steely there.
King Cobb Steely?
Yeah, there's a sticker for King Cobb Steely under the strap there. So anyway, I just, sorry.
Look at that. And there's do it yourself. That's a real DIY sticker from way back when, because it says create anarchy. Do it yourself, create anarchy.
Ah, there you go. Well, so all this to say, so weirdly, you've been on my mind. I told you I found the Royal City live tapes, which probably don't sound great. I'm gonna try to listen to them
Well, I mean, at your own risk. You might you might be drinking by the time you're finished that.
And then, yeah, I was in the garage. I'm like, oh, yeah, I have Aaron's snare drum. And then I hear from your friend and mine, Sam, at the Hillside Festival, that you've agreed to perform a song for their virtual festival that's taking place July 24th to 26th. You're going
to
submit...
I have to do that this week, right?
I think that's correct. So, and we don't have to talk about the song. Maybe we'll leave it as a surprise. But given what we were talking about, I thought this was astounding. He asked me for your email address or if you still use one particular email address. And I said, I think so. But, and I knew maybe he was going to ask you about something like this. He didn't say he was. And I just like, he's not going to, Aaron doesn't do anything. He's not going to say yes. Why did you say yes to this?
I don't know, because it's Sam. I mean, it also, it's easy to do. I mean, I am going to play a song that I play, you know, not every day, but, you know, probably once a week.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, whatever.
That's
I'm happy. I'm happy to do it.
Does Hillside, mean something specific to you?
Hillside?
Just as a festival. Is that a meaningful entity?
I don't know if Hillside means something to me. You know, Guelph is where I was born. And I mean, I know everybody that went to Hillside. I've got all kinds of great memories of Hillside. And I mean, I know the faces. And so Hillside is an organization. I could care less about it. I don't care about organizations, but I love Sam and I love Vish and I love Michael Markley.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay.
I love Lewis.
Yeah. Lewis Melville still.
So,
yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's great. It's a history.
Yeah. You don't miss Guelph per se, do you? I mean, you miss the people.
There's lots of things about Guelph I miss. Yeah, sure. I mean, I miss every moment of my life. I miss every moment of my life when I look back on it. But it's a great nostalgia because it's something that's present. It's something that constitutes who I am now. So
yeah.
I miss it most of all in the sense of being grateful for it. Whether it's Guelph, whether it's Charlottesville, Virginia, New York City, Nottingham, England. You know, two of my kids were born in Nottingham.
Yeah, you lived everywhere. Yeah.
They were baptized in the same font as Graham Greene.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
In the Nottingham Cathedral. And then Granada in Spain. And now Atchison. I mean, it is amazing. I never thought that I would end up in a town that was less significant than Guelph. but I thought it was like sort of only, you know, New York, Charlottesville, Nottingham, Granada, like they all had their sort of je ne sais quoi, which was like, wow, right. This is a really awesome, awesome place.
Right. Right.
But Atchison really could only be as big as a minor footnote to Guelph.
Well, I'm sure your fellow citizens would appreciate you saying that. We'll make sure they hear this. I do want to, you know, I was saying maybe we don't want to spoil the surprise. You're on the call here with me. What song are you going to perform for the Hillside Festival, and why did you choose it? I'd like to know.
Okay, I think I'm supposed to say this on the video that I actually record too. So I'll just repeat myself. It doesn't matter.
Sure.
Anybody who's had the misfortune of spending any time with me has heard me say things twice.
me too. Absolutely.
So I'm going to do a song by Victor Jara. Victor Jara is a Chilean folk singer. He was a socialist, a communist, Marxist. I heard his name probably for the first time when I was about 16 or 17 years old, because on the Sandinista album of The Clash and the song Sandinista, you know, do you remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium fighting those Washington bullets, something like that.
That's my favorite Clash album.
Oh, is it?
Every Sunday, almost, if I think of it, I have what I call Sundanista, and I play the triple record. It's a triple vinyl. I play Sandinista, and I enjoy it. It's like a beautiful Sunday mixtape, I think.
Yeah. Well, and it kind of sounds like a mixtape as records go.
That's why I think I like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so sorry.
sort of like the self-portrait of the Clash.
Yeah, it is. It is a little like that, in that they're kind of covering themselves a little bit, yeah, and doing different takes on things and rapping, and it is a complete, you know, they can be accused, like a lot of people can, of appropriation, I suppose, but it's weird for me that all that talk of that stuff. You also, as a student of folk music, as I am, know how appropriation can get kind of discussed. And then at the same time, I feel like, well, if I didn't know about it from these things, I might not have known about it at all. And that, as a person who likes to know things, that just got me into stuff. Like, I went down different rabbit holes because of Sandinista. I went down different rabbit holes because of Dylan, you know?
Yeah.
And found blues singers or artists that I just would not have maybe entered my... I feel like there's this, yeah, it's a confusing time to be talking about these things, but there is a way to show reverence to your influences and pay them tribute by pointing people to them that I appreciate in certain artists. So anyway, sorry, tangent.
Maybe it has to do with a real sense of authority and the sense of deep friendship for someone who came before. And if you play somebody else's song, or you discover somebody else's music, which even isn't culturally your own, and you have a deep love for it, then you don't appropriate it, because you don't seek to make money off of it. You don't seek to dominate it. You seek to participate in it and to gesture other people towards
it.
Yeah. And that's the difference. But, you know, people ripping off other people, I mean, we're all against that. Right?
No, that I'm against. But I think when someone mentions a name, like you just said, you heard about this artist because the Clash mentioned him.
Yeah.
So on some level, they were doing some sort of people. Some people wouldn't see it that way, but I view that as a bit of a service.
I mean, so and the Clash had great taste in music.
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah, and they were open-eared, and that's what I appreciated about them.
Yeah. So this song, Victor Jara. So he was obviously killed in the revolution and by Pinochet's henchmen and stuff. But the song that I'm gonna sing is a song called Te Recuerdo, Amanda, which is I Remember You, Amanda. And it's a beautiful song about an encounter between a man and a woman. And my favorite thing about it is he says, in 5 minutes, all of eternity was present. And that's, I think, the same thing that we were talking about earlier about punk rock, is that whatever we hope for in life, it's something that we've already seen, you know?
Hmm.
We can't hope for something that doesn't exist.
Right.
And so it may not be fully realized, but we've seen it. And so in the encounter of this man and this woman, there's like this sense of eternity was in 5 minutes, and the truth of humanity and the sort of, in his case, the fight for a better world, is sort of fueled. And it's a beautiful, beautiful song.
Well, it's, I'm so happy that, Victor inspired you to participate in this thing. I mean, the fact that you're going to play a song after so many years of not doing so in a way that we could all experience is it's just a real gift, Aaron. I you know, we all miss you I miss you as a friend, and I miss seeing you, but I also miss you as a musician. And so this is lovely. I'm glad you're doing this. I just want to say that.
Just got to come around my living room.
Well, I can't. I'm not going anywhere. I don't leave the house because of the COVID.
Well, I mean, it's like Jim always said, home is where the rock is.
That's right. Jim Guthrie always said that. Now, if we could, traditionally at the end of a conversation like this, I'll ask a guest who is a musician to select a song of their own to go out on. And I know you're pretty self-conscious. You mentioned the ego thing. But if we could, just to give people a sense of something of yours from anything, I can find it unless I don't have it. Maybe I can talk to you after. But just anything. If you could pick a song that you had a hand in creating and recording, what would it be?
I'm not exactly sure what the title of it is. Is it called Dirty Fingernails?
Yeah, from
Okay, yeah.
I think that's, you always used to name things after the first sentence or few words of the song, right? Generally.
Well, that was just I copped what, you know, W.H. Auden did.
Yeah, right. So you would just that's right. So Dirty Fingernails, why did that come to mind?
I don't know, 'cause I think that, well, I mean, there's, I also, Raw Youth. There's the only.
Isn't Dirty Fingernails called "Don't You Ever Be"? No, that's what you say in that song.
Yeah, I don't know. It could be. That's what it could be called. That.
Okay, I don't know because
it's a song. It's a song that I wrote that I still play it every once in a while.
What do you remember? What inspired that one?
No, not really.
Per se? No. Okay.
I mean, I know exactly what it was about.
You know what it was about? You don't want to say.
Well, I can say. It was about Dirty Fingernails by the Balcony Rail.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
There's a great interview with T.S. Eliot on the BBC, and the guy asks him, "Can you tell us, you know, Mr. Eliot, this is a fantastic new poem you've come out with, you know, the Burnt Norton. Can you explain to us what this means? Because some people find it very philosophical." He says, "Yes, yes, of course I could tell you. It means time present and time past." He just starts reciting the poem.
Right.
As his explanation.
Okay, well, let's go to that. I appreciate. So we're going with Dirty Fingernails, or did you say Raw Youth? I
can't remember. Sure. Okay. No, Dirty Fingernails. Great. Okay.
All right, let's play that. This is Royal City with Dirty Fingernails. Aaron, thank you so much for this time. It was good to connect, and I wish you the best of luck with everything, and I hope I see you soon, buddy. I miss you. I love you. Talk soon.
Okay. Bye. Thanks, Vish.
Dirty fingernails by the balcony rail, my lovely, you are so frail. Cigarette ends all of my friends departed. Empty ashtray of cigarette ends. And don't you ever be what they want you to be. And don't dung in ditches and illness in muddy places, after which what forgiveness? Into the ear of death I cast all my regret. To the dirty ear of death. And don't you ever be what they want you to be. And don't
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Before I get into the normal outro of the show, we have to fact check something, as I suspected, but did not push back on too hard. The song that you just heard by Royal City is not called Dirty Fingernails. It's called Don't You. I said it was called Don't You Ever Be something something. I didn't have it in front of me, and Aaron, I don't know if he pretends not to know things about himself or if he really doesn't know. But anyway, sorry. It's the Royal City song. Don't You is what you just heard. And that was the great Aaron Riches, my dear old friend, on this, the 553rd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all Apple and Google platforms and other things as well. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, you've heard about it from someone, but you can't find it on any of those platforms. The platforms are all mixed up. They're all weird, man. They don't have everything. Well, you know, you can still find those things. And you can also learn more about me and sign up for my semi-regularly scheduled newsletter. All at my website, vishkana.com, which is spelled exactly how it sounds. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter, @vishcreative, or follow me directly, @vishkana. Also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. And $6 or more a month gets you access to exclusive archival audio content from my history, interviewing people like Sufjan Stevens, D.A. Pennybaker, Olive Fugazi, Killer Mike, Hal Wilner, Will Oldham, all sorts of people. Go to patreon.com/creativecontrol. And I have to say, I just moved to Edmonton, Alberta, as you may know if you follow the show. I have much easier access to my collection of Creative Control t-shirts, and there's still quite a stockpile of them. I just am sending one to someone in Boise, Idaho, because they made a Patreon donation, and I said, you know what, I'll just send you a shirt. I didn't tell them I need to get rid of them, but I kind of want to get rid of them. And also, what the hell, guy said he's giving me $10 a month. At least he could get as a t-shirt as well as the audio content. Anyway, patreon.com/creativecontrol if you want to get in on the audio and t-shirt action. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in the Royal City itself, Guelph, Ontario, which I miss, Aaron misses. Also, Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. All of these fine people offer their in-kind support for the show, so thank you to them. We mentioned Jim Guthrie, I think, briefly in our conversation, and Jim lends me music for the show, one of my oldest friends. Go to jimguthrie.org to learn more about Jim. And you, finally, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with Aaron Riches, and I hope you'll check out the back catalog of episodes, subscribe to the podcast to keep tabs on it, and tell your friends. Tell your friends about the show. Maybe they'll like the show. You never know. You never know. You might know. You know your friends. You don't know if they'll like it. Maybe you don't. Maybe you need new friends. Anyway, I'm getting in your head now. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
wrong part.
Why do you keep doing that?
After this part. It's still the wrong part. I thought he had it queued up closer.
Fucking...
Get right here.
Okay, here we go.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.